From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is Which Way LA.
A green political agenda for city elections. I'm Alex Chadwick, sitting in for Warren Olney. This is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Anti-tax activist Grover Norquist won power and fame by getting Republicans to sign a pledge to never vote for a tax increase. Maybe that's what environmentalists should try, a pledge. A new study looks at how the city of Los Angeles could become a lot greener through the next two mayoral terms, cut emissions, use less water, boost solar and wind. And the study says anyone who wants to get elected mayor or to the city council should sign on. One concern, how do we know what it might cost? Also tonight, a new landing at LAX. Local eateries and shops get into the retail mix. And later on, the great drone debate. Warren Olney will be here with legal analysis. First news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Alex Chadwick sitting in for Warren Olney with Which Way LA on KCRW. Warren will be here a little later. He's talking about drone warfare today. First, New York has one. San Francisco, Philadelphia. Big cities that also plan to be sustainable cities. Sustainability means living and working so that the world remains livable for generations to come. It means cutting carbon emissions that build a warmer climate, using less water, generating less waste, and still ensuring an urban life that offers opportunity and justice. A new study from UCLA, Visions 2021 LA, a model environmental sustainability agenda for Los Angeles's next mayor and city council. That's the title of the study. It examines almost a dozen of what it calls goal areas with far-ranging green policy prescriptions that would remake Los Angeles. The study advocates asking politicians to sign on, a pledge to actually try to make this work if elected. Mark Gold is a lead author. He's a former director of Heal the Bay. Now he's at the UCLA Institute of the Environment and Sustainability. It issued the study along with the Emmett Center on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA Law School and the Evan Frankel Environmental Law and Policy Program also at UCLA Law. Mark Gold, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
And your time frame for this sustainability plan is 8 years. You specifically gear it to the next two mayoral terms. Why is that?
Well, a lot of times these sustainable city plans are looking at years, 20 years out, 30 years out. And the reality is that administrations really only have control over when they're actually in office. And so we're about to have a new mayor in the city of Los Angeles, and the city council is turning over quite dramatically as well. And so really two terms is the most the mayor can be in there. And really, that's the time frame in which they can really make a big difference on sustainability within within the city. And it also creates some accountability during that time frame.
Okay. So I mentioned the Grover Norquist pledge model a little earlier. You know, he threatens to find someone to run against any politician who's reluctant to sign his anti-tax pledge. How would you enforce a pledge here, which you clearly are asking for?
Well, I don't think enforcement is really the issue. The issue is to really up the ante on the dialogue surrounding the future of Los Angeles and sustainability over the next 8 years. We've seen all too often, if you've ever been to some of these environmental debates, where the candidates are arguing over who's greener by who has the best recycling program in their home or apartment, or how many pocket parks they created within their council districts. And what this is going to lead to a far more sophisticated discussion on the future of Los Angeles.
These are big things in your plan. Tell us your big priority.
Well, there's many big priorities, but I think all of the authors agreed that dealing with energy and climate change preparedness is really the top issue. And where we came up with these targets, as well as goals and implementation recommendations, a lot of them actually came from the city of Los Angeles and some of their future plans and proclamations from Mayor Villaraigosa. They also came from looking at a lot of the sustainable city plans from around the country, and then also many of the experts who worked on this. So that being said, getting to the point of weaning Los Angeles from the use of coal, where right now 45% of our energy comes from coal, and moving forward to 40% renewable energy is probably two of the biggest things on there from the standpoint of energy and climate and what we can do. And there's a lot more than that in that area, everything from green buildings to putting together a regional climate preparedness strategy to protect Los Angeles residents and city infrastructure from the changes that are inevitably going to occur because of climate change.
You know, the mayor, our current mayor, did at one point talk about a sustainability plan for L.A., and he gave up on it because of the recession. These things cost a lot.
Yeah, there's no question about it that moving towards a more sustainable city is going to cost money. And many of the recommendations within this plan include the area of how to generate revenues to implement many of these measures. But a lot of the other ones are not costly. And if you look at it in the longer term, the energy efficiency side, the water efficiency side, those are things that are going to benefit the city even economically in the long term. And moving us more towards a green economy within the city of L.A., creating 100,000 new green jobs, those are going to benefit us as well.
Mark Gold on Vision 2021 L.A. Dakota Smith is a staff writer at the Los Angeles Daily News, where she covers land use, city planning, and politics. Dakota, welcome back to Which Way L.A.? And where are we? Just remind us, in the election cycle, who's in so far?
Well, right now there's about four front runners. There's City Controller Wendy Gruhl, and then there's City Council persons Eric Garcetti and Jan Perry, and then there's Kevin James, a former prosecutor, and he's also the only Republican. And those four people are getting the most attention and the most money at this point.
So you had a piece in the paper about this, and what is the response from people in politics to this study now and these candidates?
You know, I think that they really actually welcomed the study. They, the ones that I talked to, were able to talk to, they both gave me statements saying that they welcomed, you know, having a dialogue about green issues. I think particularly after the presidential race, where we really didn't see any environmental issues discussed, that these candidates who are mostly, you know, very liberal and already have been doing some green initiatives are going to, you know, really seize on these issues and try to push them forward. I think that, as you know, some people have said to me, though, the implementation is going to be the key test here. And it's easy to have a dialogue about these issues, but I'd like to hear what the, you know, I think people want to hear what the candidates are really going to do to actually get these goals implemented.
Well, implementation and cost, that involves cost, doesn't it? And is there any, has anyone put a dollar figure on this that you know of?
I haven't seen a dollar figure yet. I think we're too early in the scheme of things. But I think that that's an important point, is that, you know, cost can get in the way of some of the bigger visions, especially right now with the city's budget the way it is.
So in the story that you wrote in the paper about this study, you quote one Valley resident who says, hold on, I'm not sure that this is the direction I want to go.
Well, that was actually he looks like he lives in Century City, Mike Eveloff, and he's a homeowner who actually sued the city with some other neighbors a couple of years ago, saying that, hey, you haven't really figured out how to make the city sustainable in terms of water and streets and our infrastructure, but you keep allowing development to occur. And so he was very interested in the study because what the study does is sort of take a more holistic look at the city's planning process. He felt like it was sort of too pie in the sky, these ideas, which I know that Gold doesn't agree with, but he felt that they were sort of overshooting, UCLA was overshooting with their suggestions for the mayoral candidates. For instance, you know, the issue of infrastructure, our roads aren't great, and that can sometimes deter people from taking the bus. So he wants people, you know, the city to address its roads before we start looking at the bigger issues of, before the environmental issues are all considered.
Let me ask you about one political aspect of this. You've covered debates. There's one coming up in, what, I think 10 days or so by the League of Conservation Voters. Do you think that candidates will take a real pledge on an issue like this? Is this something they would do?
I think they will. I've watched them at other debates, and they're not shy about committing to do things. I think that some of these visions are pretty broad, too, that if they want to wiggle out of them at a later date, they might be able to. So I think that they will pledge on many of these initiatives.
Mark Gold, the pie in the sky aspect of the plan?
Well, it's interesting. I actually, not surprisingly, strongly disagree in that there's really a range of recommendations within here. And one of the things that we did was have 40 different sustainability experts take a hard look at this. And one of the things that we asked them to look at was not only whether they agree with the recommendations, but whether or not they're feasible within the 8-year period. And if you look at it as a whole and say, hey, is every single one of these things doable within the next 8 years? The answer is no. But each one of these individually, if there was a firm commitment, not only from the mayor, but the city council, as well as the business community and the public, absolutely it could occur. And, you know, there's been so much discussion in each and every one of these areas, like water and like waste, on trying to be more self-reliant on water supply and how do we actually get there. And so those are the things that are in here that have been discussed at length. And as for the infrastructure issue, we make it very, very clear that the infrastructure, the gray old infrastructure, is falling apart for areas like water supply and needed to be replaced by much more reliable and environmentally beneficial low-impact development, green infrastructure, as well as we're talking about the green energy infrastructure as well.
Okay, hold on just a moment. David Nahai is an environmental attorney, former head of the L.A. Department of Water and Power, and he's one of the 40 experts you mentioned who reviewed this study before it was released for the authors. David Nahai, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So you are a kind of a reviewer of this study. What did you tell them about it? What do you think?
Well, let me take a moment to commend Dr. Gold and his team on the completion of this study and its comprehensiveness. You talked about the study, as if it's a study that's just kind of come out of some kind of immaculate conception, but it isn't. This study builds on many others. In Los Angeles, we have sustainable plans. It's just that they're all over the place. They're at LADWP, they're at the Department of Public Works. And what this particular report does is that it gathers a wealth of information and then builds on it and tries to be aspirational and look to a future that improves upon the existing goals that we have. In other words, it poses the question, we know what we can do. We've said what we can do in these various departments. Now let's take a look at what we could do if we had the necessary political will with the renewed vigor of a new administration and, quite frankly, with the support of the public so that the funding can be gathered for this. So if you take a look at, the water program, for instance, LADWP currently has a set of principles to the effect that we'll get 37% of our water from local resources, from conservation, from wastewater recycling,
yes,
et cetera. What this study asks is that that goal be accelerated to 32%, not 37%, but by 2021.
So a number of the recommendations in the study actually take things that are planned over perhaps decades and squeezes them into a much shorter time frame. Is that something that an institution like the Department of Water and Power that you used to run, could they do that?
Well, I mean, as far as the talent within the department is concerned and at the Department of Public Works, in my opinion, without a doubt, there are some very, very gifted people, dedicated public servants in the city of Los Angeles. But they need backing, they need support, and quite frankly, they need money. And, what happened with the water rate increases this year is that they were deferred. And there were reasons for that. But we also have to take a look at this report. This isn't just a set of, nice luxury items. For water, we're currently, dependent on water from outside the city to the tune of 90%. That water is becoming less available and more expensive. So we also have to think of the cost of not acting. What is the cost of not acting? What is the cost of not acting on the power side with cap and trade regulations and the prohibition on importation of coal power? and many laws that we have to comply with, the ones through cooling laws and so on.
But, Mr. Nahai, there are always questions about resources and where they're going. And the fire chief is telling the city council in a public hearing, I can't get the ambulances to run quickly enough because you won't give me enough money.
Yes. But now for LADWP, remember, it has the ability to, you know, it has its own income stream. Many of these items are not going to cost money. The other thing that I think we should bear in mind is that in LA, we have gone to 20% renewables by 2010 from 3% back in, I think, 2004. We've cut water consumption in this city by 20%, and we haven't had the kind of, you know, cataclysmic, you know, rate explosions that that people fear. In other words, if we approach this in a way that's cautious, that's planned, I think that we can get to a place where we can cut our greenhouse gas emissions, get more water self-sufficiency, get a cleaner power a portfolio without rate shock.
Let me just ask you again, Mark Gold. Revenue streams, which David Nahai mentions here, that actually means people paying more money. Are they ready to do that for something like renewable energy goals by 2021?
I think what we need is greater consumer confidence, and people need to be reminded what the city of Los Angeles has done to achieve that. So a great example would be what's occurred in rebuilding the entire wastewater system, that was the Bureau of Sanitation, to ensure that they were in compliance with the Clean Water Act and to reduce sewage spills as well as clean upgrade Hyperion. They did that, and they did it in an extraordinary manner and got national awards for that. They're doing the same thing on solid waste, and they're trying to get to 87% diversion rate from landfills by 2021. So really incredible stuff, and they have the history in which to back that up. So I think if you get that consumer confidence, and here's the big part, if we can actually ensure that these rate increases that are going to go to changing our energy supply to being renewable energy and less polluting, and giving us better local water supply, that those rate increases are going actually to modernize our infrastructure and modernize our approach to make sure that it's more environmentally sustainable, I absolutely positively think that the public can get behind it. They just need that assurance with the rate increases that the rate increase is going to go to those actual projects and those improvements.
To go to something that people really want, let me, you know, there are so many different recommendations in this study. Here's one, and it's a reasonable sounding suggestion. A fleet of zero emission vehicles available for low income people to use when they need a car for something. It does sound like a good idea, but also a pretty new idea and something that the community isn't paying for now and isn't used to paying for. How would that go down, Dakota?
There's been car sharing programs that have been tried in various parts of the city, I think, to varying degrees of success. So, and I know in other cities they've done well. So I would imagine that's something that, you know, if the city partnered with a private company, they could probably pull off pretty well. I think a lot of these initiatives, you know, they're setting the bar, I think, high in some places and then, you know, very attainable in others. And, you know, like Mark Gold said, it's really to get the mayoral candidates talking about this and I think to hold them accountable. I mean, already I think people are talking about Mayor Villaraigosa's environmental legacy now as he sort of prepares to leave office. And just to have this in the forefront, I think, is important. And I think it's going to be discussed, you know, more as the campaign goes on.
Dakota Smith, she's a staff writer for the Los Angeles Daily News, where she covers land use, City Hall, and the mayor's race. Thank you, Dakota Smith.
Thank you.
And Mark Gold, he's professor and associate director of the UCLA Institute of the Environment and Sustainability, lead author of Vision 2021 LA. Mark Gold, thank you.
You're welcome.
And David Nahai, he's president of David Nahai Consulting Services and a partner in the law firm of Lewis Brisbois. He's a former general manager of the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. David Nahai, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And coming up, in even the biggest plans, it's the details that matter. So if you're rebuilding LAX, someone should think about the food court, and someone did. We'll be right back with Which Way LA.
You're listening to Which Way LA from KCRW. Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/whichwayla or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter at WWLA.
This is Which Way LA. I'm Alex Chadwick. Coming up, Warren Olney on the drone debate in Washington. First, the LAX rebuild is the biggest public works project in the city history, and it now includes a little more local color and flavor. The airport today released the names of LA restaurants and shops that will get space in the Bradley International Terminal when it is done. Leslie Barger-Suter is dine editor at Los Angeles Magazine. Leslie, who is in?
Lots of LA restaurants are in, which is really exciting and surprising, I think. Those of us who've flown into Tom Bradley International at any time or out of are probably used to the chain restaurants and fast food and maybe a bad burrito from a Mexican chain that's in there. But we're getting a lot of really local flavor, including some of the trendiest restaurants in LA, including, I would say, Michael Voltaggio, who won Top Chef. He's opening his sandwich shop, which is called Ink Sack, that he does really interesting, innovative sandwiches. They're about $5 each, so it's actually pretty affordable.
Huh.
You've also got Border Grill, which is a legend locally. That's Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Fenniger, who did their Latin, their pan-Latin cuisine. That's going to be there as well. You know, recent big names like Umami Burger, which of course makes, you know, these incredible burgers. And then also the owner of that, Adam Fleischman, his pizza concept, 800 Degrees, which is currently in Westwood, is also going to be doing Neapolitan pizzas there as well.
Wow. So this sounds like a fairly good range of the LA eat scene.
It is. And, you know, it's going with the trend that airport dining in other countries, especially Asia, have been going for at least a decade. So we're actually a little behind in terms of having good food. And, you know, they call the airport the sort of LA's front door, and they're not wrong in that way. It is it's sort of an investment in our own tourism, I think, and it reflects the city's dining scene as a whole, which has also gotten, I think, worthy of being sort of at the front door of Los Angeles.
Hmm. So is this are these places offering the kind of food that should you sit down and eat this, or is this something you can grab and take on a plane?
It's a mix. I think there's sit-down concepts. Border Grill will be doing a sit-down concept. I think there's going to be a dining terrace where there'll be more fast casual operations where you can just grab and go. I know one of those, the Larder at Tavern, which is Suzanne Goyne, who's a huge name in LA dining, is doing her more casual larder, which is takeout pastry and cheese and meats and sandwiches and that kind of stuff. But then you've also got with the Petrosian Caviar and Champagne Bar, which, I mean, talk about decadent for the airport, but if one feels like having some beluga and bubbly while waiting for their flight, why not?
Sure. And a cupcake. You can cake cupcakes on a plane.
It would not be in LA anything without a cupcake option. So yeah, Vanilla Bake Shop, which is an established name in cupcakes, is going to be serving those for travelers with a sweet tooth as well.
How do you like the ethnic diversity in this mix?
You know, it's pretty good. You know, you've got Border Grill, which of course, you know, critics of actual Mexican food might say that it's, you know, it's the more Americanized version, but they do get a lot of ethnic flavors in there, and that'll have everything from sort of Caribbean, Latin, Cuban flavors, things like that they're known for. But then you've got Lucky Fish, which is a popular sushi chain that's going to be doing great sushi, is already very popular. And, you know, you have Pink Berry, which is a Korean frozen yogurt thing that's already there. So it's a mix. Chaya, which is a bit Japanese, Californian. You know, they could definitely have more Korean options in the mix. I think our diversity of South American cuisines is broader than this. But in terms of restaurants that you're going to get in an airport, and at least in keeping them local and, you know, non-chain, I think this is a really great lineup.
So does this mean that LA has kind of attained some status as a culinary destination?
I think absolutely. I think the fact that they're willing to invest this kind of money into, you know, Westfield developing this program with LAX, I think really says that the city is ready to pump its dining as being one of the main draws of the city. And, you know, it is. If you're going to be coming here and if you're going to taste an Umami burger and if it's the best burger you've ever had, then there's a high likelihood that you're going to go and seek out those businesses once you enter the city. So I think, or if you're not, if you're just on a layover too, it's enough to maybe make you come back. So I think the fact that they're really using this and they're promoting the city with some of our local food is, I think, a really good sign for the city and its food scene.
So this is all at the Tom Bradley International Terminal. What about the other terminals? Do you know if something is planned there? Because, okay, for the internationals, but a lot of people fly domestically.
Yes. Most of us, unfortunately, are probably not going to get to eat at any of these places anytime soon unless we're, you know, taking our jaunt to Tokyo. But if we're not, you know, there is a plan for other restaurants to be in the other terminals. I think Pink's is already at one of the other terminals. It was about a year and a half ago that they went in. And I have heard rumblings, none of it's confirmed, but from various sort of local breweries that are interested in getting into the market and expanding beyond Tom Bradley. I'm hoping that it does. I think this is a test market. In most airports, it tends to be that they focus most of their resources on the international terminal because these are the people that are buying expensive tickets and they're going to want to eat expensive food.
Right.
So I think that tends to be the trend. I do expect that if this takes off and if it works, I think that this is the sort of a phase one of hopefully overhauling the dining scene at the whole airport because I think all of us Angelenos know that it could use it.
Leslie Barger-Suter, Dine Editor at Los Angeles Magazine. Leslie, thank you.
Thank you.
And in a moment, Warren Olney on drone warfare when Which Way LA continues.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. First of all, thanks to Alex Tradwick for doing the first part of our program. Now this, the Washington Post reported this week that the Pentagon has plans to send hundreds of spies overseas, increasing the military's role in gathering intelligence. Will the new agents be identifying targets for unmanned drones, weapons currently deployed by the CIA? Greg Miller is reporting a series called The Permanent War for the Washington Post. He joins us now. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
How do you see this? Give us the context and what new changes are taking place.
Well, you just asked a question a second ago whether these new officers would be finding targets for CIA drones, and that may not be the case, but it's very likely they'll be finding targets for military drones, especially those operated by the Joint Special Operations Command, which conducts drone strikes alongside the CIA against Al-Qaeda targets in Yemen and elsewhere. But more broadly, Warren, this reflects an effort by the Obama administration to sort of institutionalize its approach to counterterrorism. It has this is an administration with a deep affinity for covert action and clandestine intelligence collection over conventional force as a solution for national security problems. So I think that this fits directly into that pattern of this administration wanting more spies and more sort of small-scale, they would argue, surgical weapons for what they expect to be a long-term conflict against Al-Qaeda and other groups.
What about the CIA? Where is it left in this picture?
Well, you know, in the past, any time the Pentagon has tried to add spies or in other ways venture into espionage, it's always created these turf battles. In this case, it's really interesting because they have complete buy-in from the CIA this time. And that is because the CIA gets to maintain control in the end over espionage operations overseas, including those undertaken by the Pentagon, but also because the CIA is so overstretched with intelligence demands that it welcomes the opportunity basically to farm out a lot of work that the Pentagon generates, a lot of questions that they have about overseas threats. Now they can say, here, let these DIA guys track down the answers to those questions. We're going to focus on what the White House wants.
And you've pointed out, too, in your story that there's been a lot of personnel movement back and forth between the CIA and the Pentagon at the very top.
Yeah, it's a remarkable moment, and one of the officials I talked to said, yeah, the stars have been aligning on this for a while. When you look at across the tops of these organizations, you have a lot of crossover. Obviously, you have Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, who was previously CIA director, but beneath him at the Pentagon, there are other agency people. One of the most important is Michael Vickers, who is best known as sort of a character in the movie and the book Charlie Wilson's War, a CIA guy who was involved in arming the Mujahideen in Afghanistan back in the 1980s. He's now running the intelligence operations for the Pentagon, and this effort to create more, to enlist more spies by the Pentagon is his brainchild. And over at the CIA, you've had the same thing until, you know, until last month when Petraeus resigned, when the director Petraeus resigned abruptly. You had another instance, which we've had several of in recent years, of a senior military officer running the CIA.
Greg Miller, once again, intelligence reporter for The Washington Post. Amy Ziegert is senior fellow at the Hoover Institute and a professor at Stanford University. She writes the intelligence column at Foreign Policy magazine. Her most book is Eyes on Spies, Congress and the United States Intelligence Community. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
How do you like this idea of the kind of transformation that Greg Miller is talking about with a lot more spies? We're talking about 1,600 spies being sent out by the Pentagon.
Well, I think we need to be very wary and cautious about this move. As Greg's great reporting shows, it's a major development. And I think there are two real questions here. The first is accountability. What we've had over the past few years is the Pentagon increasingly getting engaged in spy operations and covert action that really isn't under the same kind of accountability, either in the executive branch, getting approval by, say, the Secretary of Defense and the President, or by Congress. The same activities that if the CIA were conducting them would be subject to much more rigorous accountability. So that's the first concern. The second concern is just effectiveness. You know, the Pentagon's primary mission is to fight. The CIA's primary mission is to learn. And when you start taking on multitasking, which is essentially what the Pentagon is now doing, you run the risk of actually degrading those core competencies. And I think that's a real risk, particularly for the CIA, and letting the Pentagon take so much of the human intelligence collection piece.
So you're saying then that the military will be doing more and the CI less when it comes to intelligence, Greg Miller, is that right?
Not necessarily, but what Amy's point is a really important one. It's the blurring of the once distinct missions of these organizations. Now, some people will note that at its origin, the CIA was a paramilitary kind of organization. But in recent decades, its focus has been on intelligence collection. And when you ask very senior former CIA people about the direction for the agency over the past decade, it's been overwhelmed by its military function. Drone strikes, it's carried out hundreds of them in Pakistan, it's carried out dozens in Yemen, but inside agency headquarters at Langley, it has reoriented itself around that mission. It regards, you know, firing an advanced weapon now as one of its core missions. And many people believe that that comes at the expense of intelligence collection.
Are you surprised then, Amy Ziegert, that there aren't more turf battles shaping up over this?
A little bit, but I think it's important to point out that the CIA is in a very weak position right now. So this is the opportune moment for the Pentagon to be recommending this. We've had three different CIA directors in the past 4 years. We've had General Petraeus, who was never an intelligence guy, running an agency and turning it much more into a military-oriented organization. And now we have the sex scandal and the organization now without a confirmed leader. So it's a very weak organization. And as Mark Twain famously said, the best time to kick a man is when he's down. I also think that there's a bit of a Faustian deal going on here. For all the reasons that Greg mentioned, top CIA people are in favor of this move. But I think that it's a short-term deal with long-term consequences. The idea that the director of the Central Intelligence Agency can actually exert control over human intelligence collectors who are hired and fired and promoted by the Pentagon is a very dubious one in my mind. And it's something that the CIA has fought for control over intelligence collection coordination over the Pentagon for its entire existence and has always lost that battle.
Let me introduce Daniel Kleidman, special correspondent for Newsweek and the Daily Beast and author of Kill or Capture, The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency, a subject we'll get to a bit later in our program. Daniel Kleidman, good to have you on our show.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
You've concluded, as I understand it, that this is a device or could be a device for actually getting the CIA out of the drone program. Argue that.
Well, I wouldn't say that I've necessarily concluded that yet,
okay.
but I raise that as a possibility, and there's some suggestions in stories that the Washington Post and their excellent series written and some of the reporting that I've done that suggest that the White House may want to begin weaning the CIA off of the drone program and its kind of paramilitary function and moving it back toward its more traditional role of gathering and intelligent and analyzing intelligence. If that is the case, then by adding a significant number of covert operatives to the Defense Department's ranks, that could suggest that that is part of that process of shifting over that responsibility and having the military be largely responsible for those kinds of lethal operations. If that's the case, I think that might be a good trend. There are some accountability questions, which the other guests have raised. I think they're legitimate. On the other hand, the CIA, the Defense Department's drone program is more transparent. It is operates under a more clearly defined legal framework. And after all, lethal operations has always been the business of the military, and until recently was not so much the CIA's responsibility.
Amy Ziegert, would that be welcome to you if the CIA were to be weaned off the drone program?
It would be, and I hope that's the case. But I think the organization that needs to be weaned off CIA drone strikes is the White House, not the Central Intelligence Agency. Because having the CIA actually conduct these operations as opposed to the Pentagon is very attractive to the president, especially when a host government doesn't authorize those drone strikes, which is why, of course, the CIA has been responsible for them inside of Pakistan. So I think this really gets to what the president's incentives are, and all presidents are drawn to using the Central Intelligence Agency precisely because they can conceal U.S. involvement, even if it's a fig leaf, it's a useful fig leaf in certain circumstances.
What do you say to that, Daniel Kleidman?
I think that's right. On the other hand, I do think that there is a something of a debate going on inside the White House as to whether over-reliance on the CIA is beginning to be a problem. And this is something that I know that John Brennan has been actively talking about. The Post has written about, others have written about this playbook that John Brennan is working on to sort of institutionalize the procedures and standards for drone strikes. And my understanding is that part of that is to give serious attention to shifting away responsibility away from the CIA and toward the military. So I'm not suggesting that this is about to happen. I do agree that the CIA is very attractive to presidents for the reasons that Amy just talked about. But at least I think there's beginning to be a debate about this and how to proceed going forward.
The New York Times has recently reported that before the election, the Obama administration was looking at ways of trying to establish new rules, particularly for the targeted killings that occur using drone technology. Daniel Kleidman, what can you tell us about that report, and how does it fit into the conversation we're having?
Well, the Washington Post, I think Karen DeYoung at the Washington Post had reported about this before the election, I think maybe back in October.
Okay.
The interesting twist in the New York Times story was that there was a kind of an effort to hurry up this process so that they could get this rule book in place, or playbook as they call it, in place before the election. At that time, there was at least the possibility that Mitt Romney would be elected. That actually makes sense to me. This president, Barack Obama, is kind of quite mindful of the precedents that he leaves behind, and in a kind of an unusual way. Most presidents are interested in maintaining or even enhancing institutional power in the White House where national security is concerned. This president was, while supremely confident of his own ability to wield power, was always nervous about his successors. He just wasn't sure that he would be comfortable leaving Mitt Romney with that kind of power unless there was an institutionalized set of rules and protocols that could, in some ways, that could create sort of parameters under which the next president, perhaps Mitt Romney, would act or perhaps constrain him.
Does this suggest that the president had real concerns about the ability of a President Romney, should there have been one, to conduct the kinds of things that the president is engaged in, namely choosing the targets for targeted killings, than the president himself, than Obama was himself?
I think that's exactly what it suggested, and this concern about the power that he left behind came up in other contexts as well. In the context, I write about this in my book, of indefinite detention, when he was pushing back against his advisors early on in the administration to sort of institutionalize a regime of indefinite detention, he said, "I'm not sure I want to leave that kind of power behind. It's like a loaded weapon." He was alluding to a Supreme Court opinion, Justice Jackson's opinion in the Japanese internment case, that precedent can lie around like a loaded weapon. In fact, he explicitly said, "I'm not sure who the next president is going to be. Mitt Romney may be president 4 years from now." So he was worried about how that kind of power would be used by his successors. Again, I emphasize, he doesn't seem to have a whole lot of concern about his own ability to handle that kind of power responsibly.
Kind of an irony here. When he campaigned against the Bush administration for allowing what he regarded as the use of torture, and yet he himself is now taking responsibility in many cases, as we understand it, for determining who is going to be targeted for killing, what individual is going to be hit with a drone.
It is an irony. However, if you go back and look at what Obama said during the 2008 campaign about counterterrorism operations, he was very critical of many of the policies of the previous administration, torture, Guantanamo, even indefinite detention. He did not criticize the drone program. He did not, and in fact, to the contrary, in the one major speech he gave on counterterrorism policy in August of 2007, he somewhat obliquely essentially embraced a policy of kind of surgical strikes and even acting unilaterally in places like Pakistan. So, you know, he may have gone through a somewhat of a transformation, but I'm not sure you can accuse him of being a hypocrite, at least with regard to the drone program itself.
Okay, we can talk about irony, but not hypocrisy in this case. Daniel Clydman, once again, is with Newsweek and the Daily Beast. His book is Kill or Capture: The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. The president himself has said very little about this. One of the few references he has made, as close as he's come to personally commenting on it, was on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart in October, just before the election. Here it is.
You know, one of the things that we've got to do is put a legal architecture in place, and we need congressional help to do that, to make sure mm-hmm. that not only am I reined in, but any president's right. reined in terms of some of the decisions that we're making. Now, there are some tough trade-offs. I mean, there are times where there are bad folks somewhere on the other side of the world, and you've got to make a call, and it's not optimal.
Tom Juneau is a writer-at-large for Esquire magazine. Last July, he wrote a plea to the president called The Lethal Presidency. And then last week, he wrote a follow-up blog called How Obama Justifies Drones. Tom Juneau, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me on, Warren.
What do you take from what we just heard from the president himself? And what do you think he is, in fact, doing and has, as you report in your story, The Lethal Presidency, sent others around the country to explain?
Well, I mean, what I think he's doing is what Daniel just said. I think that he's really kind of setting up an architecture where he is free to use this power, and at the same time he sees the danger of this power of others using it. But he reserves the right and has proceeded to accelerate its use from the time he took office.
How has he accelerated it?
Well, I mean, he inherited a power from George Bush, and really, on his one of his first days of office, he signed an executive order outlawing torture. Within 3 days, he had his first drone strike and has since killed, I believe, like 2,500 people. So that's an unprecedented acceleration of the use of this these covert operations, this lethal power.
Let me go back to Greg Miller, our first guest, intelligence reporter for The Washington Post. What about this framework that has been reported that the president wants to set up, apparently so that subsequent presidents will use the kind of standards, I guess would be the right term, that he is?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Daniel kind of described it in the right way. To critics, there's an aspect of this administration seeming to say here, you guys should trust us, but we're not so sure you can trust who comes next to wield this enormous power that we have. And so the playbook is a term that Brennan has used inside the White House to describe what they're trying to put in place. And it's basically to codify this administration's approach in many categories to how it uses targeted killing, particularly through drones, armed drones. So that encompasses the legal framework, the legal memos that are still classified at the Justice Department has put together that underpin the program. That encompasses the kind of bureaucratic process that leads to these targeted killing lists. So it's the generation of names for the list, which agencies are involved, which agencies can nominate new names for these lists, who has veto power, who, how does this process work, and how does this all funnel into a document that ends up on the desk of Brennan or the president, in which he signs off on, you know, adding new names to lists of people that the United States intends to kill.
Tom Juneau, back to you. Hasn't it been the policy of the United States in the past not to conduct targeted killings?
Yeah, I mean, the advent of the targeted killing era began, you know, post 9/11. Before that, you know, we were extremely careful. It was a so-called inherent power, and that, you know, the covert operations were a power that the president had, but the use of that power, the exercise of that power, is being pursued now at an unprecedented scale.
President Gerald Ford, at some point, issued an order saying there wouldn't be any targeted killings. Isn't that right?
That's right.
And then when the Israelis began using that practice, Martin Indyk, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, said that was not American policy. We didn't approve it.
Yeah, he referred to that. This was right before, actually, 9/11. This was in around April 2000, where he referred to that power as a line that the United States does not cross.
So, Daniel Kladman, back to you with Newsweek and the Daily Beast. Kill or capture, the war on terror and the soul of the Obama presidency. Is this what you're talking about?
Well, it is. And, you know, I'm reminded that when I was covering, when I was based in Jerusalem for Newsweek in 1999 and 2000, it was the sort of beginning of the era of targeted killings for the Israelis. And Martin Indyk, as you pointed out, he referred to them as extrajudicial killings that violated our policy. And I remember the Israelis coming to me and saying, well, just wait until you face the kind of threat that we face. You may look at this differently. And I think that was prophetic. The interesting question is, getting back to this playbook for a moment, is whether the administration is simply going to institutionalize the rules that it was following at the beginning of the administration, or if there has been some evolution since they've been doing this, and whether in some ways they're thinking about leaving behind somewhat more restrictive rules for whoever comes after the Obama administration. And that's just a question I pose. I don't know the answer to that. But I wonder, for example, whether they are increasingly nervous about the use of signature strikes, which is where you don't know the identity of the people that you're targeting. You know that they are military age males, to use their parlance. So what the actual standards and kind of rules of the road that end up in this document are is going to be very interesting to know.
Tom Juneau, back to you with the Esquire magazine. You focus in on signature strikes, those strikes when people are, in fact, intentionally killed with the drones from a great distance, obviously, but you don't necessarily know who they are. What sorts of problems with that have you discovered?
Well, the administration continually talks about this is a power that it is wielding with great restraint. It continually talks about how deliberate they are. It continually talks about how precise the actual attacks are. And yet all of that discussion is there. It's never to actually limit the program. The program is always spoken about as a limited program. It's never exercised as a limited program. It's always, all the discussion about its limits are actually there to expand the use of the program. And that is, to me, the most interesting question And the central irony of this administration is really, you know, Daniel called his book Kill or Capture, but that is really a euphemism for kill. It captures very little. It kills very much. And the and for an administration that talks about its restraint and its, you know, it's almost godlike omniscience when it comes to, you know, picking the right guys, half the time it doesn't even know who it's picking.
That's all the time we have for Which Way LA. Thanks very much to all of our guests. And once again, thanks to Alex Chadwick for sitting in for me during the first half of our program. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Evan George, Lata Pana, and Francis Anderton. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can visit the Which Way LA blog for more stories about Southern California at kcrw.com/whichwayLAblog. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation and the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation.